All right, well, last week we were in Numbers, last part of 11 in chapter 12, and we were looking at a response to the demand for meat from the people. They were grumbling. They came to Moses and said they wanted meat, and Moses got tired of it. He was frustrated. And he expressed some of that to God. God, in his response to Moses, said to gather 70 men, elders of Israel, that they would gather together in the temple or the tent of the meeting, and that God would put some of the spirit that he had put on Moses in similar fashion. He would bless these men with the spirit. And tell the people as well, God told Moses, that you're going to eat meat. Not just for a little bit, not a day, not a week, but for a month, until it's coming out of your nostrils. You can tell that God is not real thrilled with their complaining. He said it's a response to your weeping before God. So here they are crying about a lack of meat while they go out and gather manna every day. And then we really picked it up in verse 20 last week. And we recognize that the people lacked thanks. They were looking at everything that didn't just come up pleasing to them. They were looking at some of the hardships, but not looking at the way that God had taken care of them. They did not have joy. They did not have thanksgiving. They didn't dwell on the God that was taking care of them and the result that was expected of going to the promised land. All they could see in their greed and complaining was God didn't provide meat. Moses, in his response to God, said, hey, we've got 600,000 men on foot on their own. Are we going to slaughter all the flocks? Are we going to empty the sea of its life so we can provide meat to these people? And the Lord responded to God, is my power limited? You'll see what I can do. And so they gathered the 70 elders. Now, two of them stayed down in the camp. And the Lord came down in a cloud, and there was a one-time event as the Spirit came on these 70 men and they were prophesying. And the two that stayed in the camp that didn't report as they were expected to began prophesying as well. And a young man runs up and reports this to Moses, and Joshua's there and he's alarmed and he said, Moses, shut that down. And Moses says, what, are you jealous for me? What? Why would you want to shut it down? I wish everybody had the Spirit and was prophesying in this way. So God swept in with a big wind, brought quail, and it said, for a day's journey in every direction, it was 3 feet deep of quail. And they went out to gather for about a 24-hour period, and the ones that gathered the least had about 60 to 70 bushels of quail. And as the meat was still in their teeth, is the way it said in Numbers, a plague came upon them. And so all we really hear about that from the book of Numbers is it became called Kibroth Hattaavah, and that means graves of lust. And it says there they buried the greedy. And so they got their quail and more than they wanted. And then when we get to chapter 12, Miriam and Aaron, and you know, we've just got through burying a bunch of people, right? Here Miriam and Aaron rebel against Moses. And their claim is, we're equal with Moses. Hasn't God spoken through us as well? God heard it. He called them out. And ultimately what we see is that God proclaimed in front of them and in front of the whole congregation then, Moses is unique. I normally speak through dreams and visions, but not so with Moses. We speak mouth to mouth. He sees me. They're like friends when they get together, conversing. And God says to them, why were you not afraid of my servant? Why were you not fearful in bringing up this complaint against Moses? And it says that God was very angry, and he departs. And when he's departed, we see that Miriam is extremely leprous. And Aaron turns to Moses in anguish. Moses turns to God and says, please heal her. And God came back and said, she's going to be unclean for a week. And so she is outside the camp for a week. They stay because of that. And after a week, she's accepted back inside the camp. And Israel moves on and arrives at the wilderness of Paran. And that's where we're going to pick it up this week. We're going to be looking at Numbers chapter 13. I'm not going to read every verse because there's some repetition in here and some good accounting of names. Which, by the way, when you read this and you see the name of this leader was this and the name of this person from this tribe was this, what does that do for you? And I'm not trying to be facetious here. I'm not trying to put you on the spot. But there's something very good about the very clear accounting that's done in the Old Testament. You see it in the names, and you see it in the generations. You see it in the dating. This person lived this long, or this many generations, and this person was the son of that person, was the son of this person. And all of that tells us that the Old Testament was very carefully written. It ought to give us a lot of encouragement that it's not just a book of generalities or a collection of books of generalities, but when we're going through these historical books, we see God at work and there's plenty to learn from it. But one thing that we can easily look over and not see is the very clear, here's the names of the people. These are real people. They were really involved, and it should give us a lot of confidence in the correctness and the attention to detail that was put into it. But let's begin by reading Numbers chapter 13. We're going to do the first four verses, then I'm going to skip down to verse 6, and then verse 8, and then verses 16 through 24. I'm not going to do this all in one reading. I'll explain as I skip why I did what I did. But let's first of all start with Numbers 13, 1 through 4. So they're now in the wilderness of Paran. They've left Mount Sinai, several days' journey. We had all of the complainers and the quail and the rebellion by Miriam and Aaron, and now we're beginning our time at the wilderness of Paran. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Send out for yourself men so that they may spy out the land of Canaan, which I'm going to give to the sons of Israel. You shall send a man from each of their father's tribes, every one a leader among them." So Moses sent them from the wilderness of Paran at the command of the Lord, all of them men who were heads of the sons of Israel. These were their names. From the tribe of Reuben, we get Shammah, the son of Zakur. And it's going to go on and give us the names of each of the people from each of the tribes. And the actual names are probably not that important to us, so it's a pattern of 12 tribes. Going to get 12 names. But I'm going to skip down and let's look at number six. And from the tribe of Judah, we get Caleb, the son of Jephunneh. I can't say that right. And so there's two guys that become famous to us in all of the Bible stories, right? Caleb and Joshua were part of the 12 tribes, spies that went out from the 12 tribes. The other one we want to look at then is found in verse 8, and from the tribe of Ephraim, Hoshea, the son of Nun. Now, who else have you heard called the son of Nun? Well, let's skip down to verse 8, and I'm sorry, down to verse 16. This is the rest of the section. This is the conclusionary statement. These are the names of the men who Moses sent to spy out the land. But Moses called Hoshea, the son of Nun, Joshua. So there's where Joshua comes in. And why the name switch, I really don't know. Let's finish out the reading, and then when we discuss this, I'll come back and hit that. There's a little information there about the meaning of the names. But continuing then, verse 16 through verse 24. When Moses, verse 17, sent them to spy out the land of Canaan, he said to them, "Go up there into the Negev, then go up into the hill country. See what the land is like and whether the people who live in it are strong or weak, whether they are few or many." And How is the land in which they live? Is it good or bad? And how are the cities in which they live? Are they like open camps or with fortifications? How is the land? Is it fat or lean? Are there trees in it or not? Make an effort then to get some of the fruit of the land. Now the time was the time of the first ripe grapes. So they went up and spied out the land from the wilderness of Zin as far as Rahob at Lebo Hamath. When they had gone up into the Negev, or they came to Hebron, where Ahiman, Sheshai, and Talmai, the descendants of Anak, were. Now Hebron was built 7 years before Zoan in Egypt. Then they came to the valley of Eshcol, and from there cut down a branch with a single cluster of grapes, and they carried it on a pole between two men with some of the pomegranates and the figs. That place was called the Valley of Eshcol because of the cluster with which the sons of Israel cut down from there. So in this part of Numbers 13, we see the spies being sent out. And why were they sent out? What was the initiating event? Go back up there and look at verse 1 a minute. What caused the spies to be sent out by Moses? God said so. Yeah, this isn't a hard question. God said, send out spies. That to me is interesting, but we'll get to that downstream from here a little bit. Send out spies. So God says, go look it over. And that they may look at Canaan and what's going to be given to them. Make sure you send one from each tribe. So Moses sent them out, beginning in verse 3. And they went out, and they did it according to the Lord's command. They sent out one from each tribe, was to be a leader ahead of that tribe, somebody important. We've seen tribes have men assigned roles from the beginning of the book of Numbers when they did a census. And when they were establishing temple worship and other kinds of things, there were times when men were designated from each tribe. This list isn't the same as any of the other lists. And not all those lists were the same either. So it's a fresh group of men. And one thing that is likely is that they're probably younger men. They need to send men out that are ready to go on to a journey throughout the land of Israel, physically fit, able. One person I read guessed they were probably about 40. And for some of us, we can understand why you would call that younger now. There were days where we wouldn't have called those men young men. But nonetheless, and the reason for that connection is our best estimate of the age of Joshua and Caleb at this point is that they're about 40. So maybe all of these men were of a similar age. We talked about verse 6, that Caleb came from the tribe of Judah. We didn't list all of the people from the tribes. In verse 8, we saw Hoshea, the son of Nun, who later on in verse 16, we read that this is also, his name is also Joshua. And Hoshea, if you look it up, means a desire for salvation. Joshua says the Lord is salvation. Is Moses thinking of names and doing something there? I mean, possibly in sending him out, they went toward the desire side. They didn't have the land yet, but really don't have anything specific on that. In verses 17 through 20, Moses gives them specific instructions. And I had a handout this morning. I hope you picked one up, and I apologize if there weren't enough to go around. I don't know if I want to apologize or just advise you of the facts. My printer ran out of ink. I had replacement cartridges, but the one that went out, the printer said, that ain't any good. So I had to stop with the number that you see back there. But the Negev, and we've talked about it before back in the book of Exodus and so on, it's down there, kind of even, that area is kind of even with the bottom of the Dead Sea there, and to the west of the Dead Sea. It's an area out there, kind of a bigger space. Beersheba is there. I'm not excited about this map, but in terms of things I could just easily go and print off, it was about the best I came up with. And we'll be using that some more as we go along. So start with the Negev, then go into the hill country. Look at the land, evaluate it. Are the people strong or weak? Are they few or many? Land, good or bad? Cities, are they open? Are they fortified? What about trees? Gather some of the fruit. And they said it was the time for the first grape part of the grape harvest, which would be probably summer, late July, something like that. And so they're sent out with these instructions. Go look at it. See what it is. Report back. So with that, let's... got a little bit more to say here. So they went up, they spied out the land in verse 21, and they went to the wilderness of Zin and to Rehob at Lake Hamath. I can't read my own writing very well. Hamath. And so it was the very south to the very north of what was to become Israel. And the people that drew this map, I mean, I'm sure they're making their best guesses. A lot of these places, we don't know where they were exactly. We get a little bit of an idea, and we can make some assumptions based on what we see here. And there are some archaeological things, but a lot of it's not very well known. But they went from the south to the north, and they went through all the land. And then when they entered the Negev, they came to Hebron, which was their first major city. And I think we need to put some context back on Hebron. Let's first of all start with Genesis 13:18. That's where we first are introduced to it. Back in the days of Abraham. Genesis 13:18. And it says, then Abraham, this is after his split with Lot, moved his tent, came and dwelt by the oaks of Mamre, which are in Hebron, and there he built an altar to the Lord. So this is a place where Abraham made a bit of a beachhead for himself, a central place to be, and it keeps coming up in the scriptures, in the Old Testament, as well as some in the New Testament. And so he built an altar there. And then also, let's go over and look at Genesis chapter 49, verses 29 through 33. Genesis 49, 29 through 33. And this is Jacob at the end of his life. And he is giving direction. He's given information about the family, prophesied over them, and so on. But this is his directions when he passes on. So I'm going to start in verse 29 and read through 33 of Genesis 49. Then he charged them and said to them, I'm about to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre, in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought along with the field from Ephron the Hittite for a burial site. There they buried Abraham and his wife Sarah, and there they buried Isaac and his wife Rebekah, and there I buried Leah in the field, and the cave that is in it purchased from the sons of Heth. When Jacob finished charging his sons, he drew his feet into the bed and breathed his last and was gathered to his people. And so this Hebron is also a focal site for them with regard to ancestral burials. As a matter of fact, what's one of the things that these folks are taking with them?
Bones.
They're taking the bones. And really specifically, they're taking Joseph's bones too, to be laid into the place where it needs to be. I believe if we went back and studied Genesis, they took Jacob's bones directly after he died at the time. But now they've got Joseph's bones that they're taking back with them. And we will find out later as we study our way through this book and through Joshua that this would become part of Caleb's inheritance, and Hebron would actually also be David's capital reigning over Judah during a portion of his reign. And this is a fortified city. So they're at the first city and they're seeing this city's fortified. It will be a strong city. And they also find the descendants of Anak there called Ahiman, Sheshai, and Talmai. And that's going to come up later when we get their report. And we'll talk about what that means. But we'll get at it in general right here and now. Go over to Deuteronomy chapter 2. Verses 20 and 21. Deuteronomy 2, 20 and 21. And this is the way this is described in Deuteronomy. And they're talking about this same site. It is also regarded in Deuteronomy 2, starting verse 20. It is also regarded as the land of the Rephaim, for Rephaim formerly lived in it, but the Ammonites call them Zamzumin, a people as great, numerous, and tall as the Anakim, but the Lord destroyed them before them, and they dispossessed them in their place. And so you can see Anak named there in Anakim, so they're reviewed as a very tall people. A better reference for just understanding it all is Deuteronomy 9:2. Deuteronomy 9:2. I'll start 1. Deuteronomy 9:1. Hear, O Israel, you are crossing over the Jordan today to go to dispossess nations greater and mightier than you, great cities fortified to heaven, a people great and tall, the sons of Anakim, who you know and of whom you have heard it said, who can stand before the sons of Anak? And so they are great, physically great people. And so they see that. And then in verse 23, they go to the Valley of Eshcol, and they were asked to bring back some fruit. What did they bring back from Eshcol?
Grapes.
And some pomegranates and some figs. So is this grape harvest, the item they bring back, is it impressive? Yeah, this is one cluster of grapes. Now, don't get me wrong, what we buy in the grocery store is not a true cluster. We buy pieces of clusters. But this is one cluster of grapes that is big enough that they put it on a pole and sling it between two people. That's what it says right here. So they get one singular cluster of grapes that is absolutely huge. And it says there in verse 23, verse 24, the place was called the Valley of Eshcol because of the cluster which the sons of Israel cut down from there. So in the vernacular of the people living there, they probably didn't call it Eshcol. But the Israelites did from this day forward. That word Eshcol means cluster. So this became the Valley of the Cluster that they brought back when they were seeking things out. And so that's why it got that name. So they went out and they saw. And we got a description of some of the things that they saw. And then in verses 25 through 33, we get to see the results of when they come back. When they returned from spying out the land at the end of 40 days, they proceeded to come to Moses and to Aaron and to all the congregation of the sons of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh, and they brought back word to them and to all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. Thus they told him and said, we went into the land where you sent us, and it certainly does flow with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. Nevertheless, the people who live in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. And moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. Amalek is living in the land of the Negev, and the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites are living in the hill country, and the Canaanites are living by the sea and by the side of the Jordan. Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, we should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we will surely overcome it. But the men who had gone up with him said, we are not able to go up against the people, for they're too strong for us. So they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they spied out, saying, The land through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great size. There also we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, are part of the Nephilim, and we became like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight. So the report comes out. They've been gone for 40 days, it says, on their spying tour of the land. When they come back and report to Moses and Aaron and all Israel, back at Kadesh in the wilderness of Paran, they show them the fruit. And verbally they describe, we went where you told us. And this land flows with milk and honey. Did they see any milk and honey? What does that phrase refer to? What's that? Well, I don't know that it refers to heaven, but all this time, God's been telling them he's going to give them a land. And how does he describe it? Flowing with milk and honey. That's their euphemism or their vernacular for this land is full of resources. And they're delightful resources. And so this is the way of saying, this is a rich land. Oh, and by the way, you want to see the cluster of grapes we brought back? And so they show them the fruit. And it's very positive. It's even confirming of what God has been saying all along. I'm going to give you a great land. And they also say, though, nevertheless, or equally important, or despite all that, the people of the land are strong. They're large. In verse 28, their cities are fortified. They're large. And even more importantly, we saw the descendants of Anak there. They're all seven-footers. They're going to hurt us, is implied. And then Amalek, an enemy that's been ongoing, they fought Amalek on their way out of Egypt as they were crossing in the same general area. Amalek is living in the Negev. And Hittites and Jebusites and the Amorites live in the hill country. And the Canaanites are there. They live both by the sea and by the side of the Jordan. And so if you look at the map, this particular map didn't say it that way, but when you see the Canaanite people, they are spread along, and this was what you'd expect. You want to be near water, right? They're spread up and down the Jordan River between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea. They're also along the coast over by the Mediterranean Sea. And so they see all these people there. Well, that's an interesting report. In verse 30, then Caleb quiets the people. So obviously there's murmuring going on. Oh my goodness, oh, woe is us. It's an obvious rumble of response regarding the obstacles that they saw. What does Caton say? Caton. What does Caleb say? Let's go. We certainly will conquer it. No hesitation on Caleb's part. So Caleb, and we don't hear much from Joshua during this encounter, the verses that we've read so far, but it's basically a 10-2 group. We know that from all the stories we've heard. And so now when I was preparing, it reminded me of a show on TV, just the title of it. It would be on some Sunday morning, so I didn't get to watch it very much, and it's fine. It probably was not much in it worth watching. I don't know, but back in the 60s, maybe 70s, Point Counterpoint. And that's almost what we have going on here. You've got the majority report coming back saying, great land, very, very well prepared to defend itself. And then you've got the counterpoint. Now, Caleb doesn't make a big speech about why, at least not that's recorded. He just simply says, let's go get it. We'll certainly conquer this land. Well, now you get back to the other side. The majority says, we're not able to go up against these people. They're too strong for us. And the result is the sons of Israel receive a bad report, a negative report, a report that says, this can't happen. It's not going to work. The land that we looked at and all the people saw, and if you're Caleb, don't you want to just jump out of your skin right here? What do you mean all the people? I'm part of the people that went, but all the people saw that this land devours its inhabitants, and all the people we saw were men of great size. As a matter of fact, we saw the Nephilim, which are big people. The son of Anak is included in that category. And how did we appear? We became like, and the words are important here, like grasshoppers in our sight. They saw us this way also. They saw us as grasshoppers in their sight. Now, I don't know how they determined that last sentence. Did they stop and say, hey, Mr. Big Tall Guy, what do I look like to you? Am I a grasshopper? I don't know how they made that last conclusion, as so many times in life when we're confronted with things that seem overwhelming, we start making assumptions, don't we? I imagine that they did the same thing. They've made a lot of assumptions here, and we're going to talk about the source of their thinking a bit as a part of how we wind this up today. But we didn't start out that way, but before we're done, we are like grasshoppers in our sight. Self-assessment. There's an author who I'll leave nameless. I don't care for very much of what he writes. He would call himself a Christian author, but he said one thing that I read many years ago that I think is true. And that is that no one can consistently behave in a manner that is inconsistent with how he views himself. In other words, if you think you can't, well, then you can't. If you think you can, then you can, or at least you're a lot more likely to be able to, but it's just not normal. Possible, other than by the work of God, for a person to live out a life that they cannot visualize as being possible. Their heart's not in it. They don't believe it will happen. And I don't think it's a question of faith. It's a question of what they're going to try because of what they expect for results. Regardless of that particular statement, these folks are, in their own minds, that are of the majority at least, are completely defeated, and they haven't even tried anything yet. So I've got some questions and some things that we need to think about and look at that come out of chapter 13 here. So let me ask this question first. What did all 12 of the spies agree on? They agreed on some things. What did they agree about?
Good land.
Good land.
Giant people.
Yeah, but it's a great land. And you would have to expect, if there's a lot of resources, there'd be people there, wouldn't you? I mean, you wouldn't expect that people would have just left it alone. Great land. Their description is a biblical one. If you look at what God continually said, it's full of flowing with milk and honey. Big cities, powerful people. What is the conclusion of the majority of the spies? Their conclusion is
too much for us.
Too much for us. We can't go against these people. What was different in Caleb's opinion?
He took into account the promises of God.
Well, now you're getting at the basis on it, but let's start with, what did he say?
Let's go.
Let's go. And we will surely conquer them. So here's Caleb with a conclusion, we're going to win. It's going to work. Let's go. And yet the conclusion of the majority is it's impossible. And so now I'll get to the question that we've already answered to a point. What additional information and opinion Oh, no, I'm sorry. Let's go a different place. What additional information and opinion is provided by the majority in verse 33? I want to answer that first. Go down to the verse 33 and look at that. What new thing did they say? What was new to the conversation?
Well, did they realize when they got there that there was going to be, well, my Bible calls everything their giants.
Yeah.
So did they realize that they were going to be up against everybody like that, little giants?
I don't have any idea what they thought before they went. I mean, obviously, they were not expecting what they saw if they thought they were just going to take the land, because they saw something that convinced them they weren't going to do it. It isn't going to happen. Can't. Not only is it not going to happen, it would be impossible to make it happen. But they bring up the point I want to make is there's something new they say in verse 33 that they hadn't said before.
They're like grasshoppers.
It's that grasshopper statement. We're like grasshoppers in their sight. I mean, in a way, they implied they're bigger than us. But then they add one more thing. And so were we in their sight. So they're bringing this in like it's fact. Well, first of all, was it a fact? Now just for fun, and I'm not a real tall guy, but if we brought a grasshopper in here and set him down on the floor, literally, is this a fair comparison of their size to these people? No. And I'm guessing here, and maybe they asked them all, what do you think of us? And they went, you look like kids. I don't know what they said. But I'll bet you they didn't say you look like grasshoppers. And they're bringing this in like it's fact. They've drawn some conclusions about what they saw and what's going on and treating those things as fact. Now, excluding verse 33, let's go back up to the other things they said. Were the majority people wrong in their descriptions of what they reported? Were they wrong? No, actually, they were pretty accurate. Great land, great resources, great fruit, great big cities, some fortified. They were right in that. And so why do you think they came to a different conclusion than Caleb voiced? And we've already had an answer to that, haven't we? Russell spoke up and said, well, Caleb was thinking about who God was and God's role in this. I think we even ought to look at why he would say that with a certain level of detail. Let's start over. It will be our main passage to do this. And I could go to multiple places. I like this one the best because it had the most description. Go over to Exodus 23, and we're going to read verses 20 through 33. Exodus 23, verses 20 through 33. If I can make my fingers turn the pages. Exodus 23, starting with verse 20. This is about the conquest of the land that God is telling him is coming. Behold, I'm going to send an angel before you to guard you along the way and to bring you into the place which I have prepared. Be on your guard before him. Obey his voice. Do not be rebellious toward him, or he will not pardon your transgression, since my name is in him. But if you truly obey his voice and do all that I say, then I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. For my angel will go before you and bring you into the land of the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Canaanites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, and I will completely destroy them. You shall not worship their gods, nor serve them, nor do according to their deeds. But you shall utterly overthrow them and break their sacred pillars in pieces. But you shall serve the Lord your God, and he will bless your bread and your water, and I will remove sickness from your midst. There shall be no one miscarrying or barren in your land. I will fulfill the number of your days. I will send my terror ahead of you and throw into confusion all the people among whom you come, and I will make all your enemies turn their backs to you. I will send hornets ahead of you so that they will drive out the Hivites, the Canaanites, and the Hittites before you. I will not drive them out before you in a single year, that the land may not become desolate and the beasts of the field become too numerous for you. I will drive them out before you little by little until you become fruitful and take possession of the land. I will fix your boundary from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines and from the wilderness to the river Euphrates. For I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you will drive them out before you. You shall make no covenant with them or with their gods. They shall not live in your land, because they will make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. Now, God, this is in the first trip up the mountain with Moses. As a matter of fact, we're just past Exodus 20. It's the trip up the mountain where he gets the Ten Commandments spoken to him. What's interesting is just the detail here, and then there's another thing coming up that we'll look at in a minute, but he said to them, a place I have prepared. So God is telling them, I've got a place I'm taking you to, I've got it ready for you, and he talks about how he's going to give them the land. I will send my terror ahead of you. So is the issue of taking this land about how these people are viewed in comparison to the people that are already living there? Not at all. They're going to be afraid of the God they serve, not them as individuals without God. I'm going to send my terror ahead of you. I'm going to throw confusion into the people. The enemies will be made to turn their backs to you. They're going to be running from you. I'm going to send hornets ahead of you to drive out. And he starts listing the very people, not in exactly the same list, that they're afraid of. I'm going to drive out the Hivites, the Canaanites, the Hittites, and others. But I'm not going to do it in 1 year, because then the land would be desolate. And then you'd have to be overtaking the land and catching up with what would happen while there weren't people living in it. So I'm going to drive them out, God says, a little bit at a time, so you can overcome that land and put it under your dominion and make it work well. I'm going to do it at the right place and the right time. And so here is Caleb. He's lived through all of this time that they have spent at the mountain, at the Mount Sinai, and all of the messages from God. And he has seen God at work, and he is obviously factoring in something that the majority is leaving out. They are looking at that in a different way. But here's something else we need to realize. Go down in chapter 24 now, and look ahead to verses 3 and 4. So Moses came down, and here's what happened. Then Moses came and recounted to the people all the words of the Lord and all the ordinances, and all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words which the Lord has spoken we will do. And Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. Then he arose early in the morning, built an altar at the foot of the mountain with 12 pillars for the 12 tribes of Israel. And they had a time of sacrifice and worship that went along with the writing down of these words and the people affirming we're going to live by these words. These people have a tough time living out what they said they would do. Because when they get in the situation that they were in when they sent the spies up the mountain, up to the Israel, what would be Israel, they saw things differently. God asked for these spies to be sent, right? That's what we said at the beginning. Well, what was he wanting them to see? Well, he knew they were going to see a great land. And he knew that they were going to see strong men. And the opportunity was there to look at that and say to themselves, look what God's going to do. They were going to, what did they call it? They called it the Promised Land. God made a promise. This is what God's going to give to us. But when they got there, the only eyes they were able to look through were their men's eyes. They saw accurately, but they lacked in their view of what they saw, the truth of God, His promises, His might, His faithfulness, His reliability, His place in all of history, the miracles He'd done coming out of Egypt, the times He had saved them, the time that He defeated the superpower of the day, Egypt, and destroyed all their armies right in front of them, and they didn't do one thing to make that happen. They could only see through what they could do themselves, what they could understand in who they were and what they were capable of doing. I want to make a comparison here. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 3. Genesis chapter 3. And I imagine most of you have already said, well, I know what that's about. That is about the fall of man. And so it is. Genesis chapter 3, we're going to look at verses 1 through 6. Now the serpent was more crafty than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made, and he said to the woman, indeed, has God said, you shall not eat from any tree of this garden? The woman said to the serpent, from the fruit of the trees of the garden we may eat. But from the fruit of the tree which is in the middle of the garden, God said, you shall not eat from it or touch it, or you will die. The serpent said to the woman, you surely will not die. For God knows that in the day you eat from it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. When the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was desirable to make one wise, she took from its fruit and ate, and she gave also to her husband with her, and he ate. There is a very direct comparison, at least in a few points, between what happened with those spies and what happened right here when the first sin occurred in the world. In verse 1 in Genesis 3, this crafty serpent inhabited by Satan asks a question, and the intended question is to instill the possibility of doubt of God. Has God really said, you shall not eat from the tree, any tree of the garden? And Eve answers. She answers pretty well. She adds a little bit. You can't even touch it. So they added that to it a little bit. But as they go through and you get to verse 4, the serpent becomes more direct. You surely will not die. So serpent, gives her an alternate result and affirms it. And then he starts assigning motive to God. God knows in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, you'll be like God, knowing good and evil. The implication is God doesn't want you to be as good as him. He's going to hold this back from you. And then in verse 6 comes a very important piece in this whole chain of events. The woman saw. Eve looked, and what did she see? That it was, in her perception, in what she was seeing, good for food and a delight to the eyes. And it was desirable to make one wise, so she ate it. Now, what she saw was limited. It was inaccurate in terms of being the whole truth. She saw with her eyes, and she saw from a human perspective, this fruit looks good. This fruit looks like good food. This fruit is delightful just in its appearance. This fruit would be good for me as a conclusion, that it would be good to know good from evil. And so she self-deceives herself. She goes to something that's not true. It isn't going to be good to have the knowledge of good and evil. It isn't good for food in the sense that it's going to nourish her and bring something good into her life and body. And I'll bet you afterwards, she wouldn't say it was delightful to look at, because she's going to have shame and regret every time she sees that fruit. Well, let's talk about the comparison to what's happening with these spies. They're looking in the land, they're looking in it to see what's here. And they look at it from their very human perspective. What is it? Do we want it? Will it do good for us? And can we, out of our might and our power, overtake it? They compared themselves in their own vision to those people and said, we can't stand up to them. And you know what? They weren't wrong. In the way they were evaluating it, they were right. But what they left out of their evaluation was, God sent us up here to spy it out. God has been leading us by a pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire. He's been saving us from our own troubles. He's forgiven us of our own sins even and our own rebellions. But he has done all these miracles to bring us here, provided food day and night. And this God has said, I'm promising this land to you. And they left all of that out of their look-see into the promised land. And it would be very easy to say that, well, isn't that obvious? How foolish of them. They set aside the obvious. But you know what? This is exactly what's happening today in our culture. In our culture today, people that have degrees or have the ability to put words together that want to reject the scriptures, some even in that say that they're Christians, some will even say they're bringing truth to the scriptures, but they say things like, does the Bible really say we created the world in 6 days and that God did that? And they've got all kinds of answers that sound all kinds of scholarly. And if we evaluate that and look at that and even consider that as, well, maybe they're right, could they be right? What we are doing is we are neglecting the truth that God gave us that's very clear in the scriptures. You've got to really work hard to make something else out of it, but they will lead us into make something else out of it. And they are so learned, and they are so good with their words, and they are so convincing in what they say, that they lead many astray. And what would never even be considered a couple centuries ago as a potential truth, like evolution, becomes now, well, science has proven it. Can you argue with science? A few weeks ago, I assume most of you probably know more about clickbait than I do, but I saw something that looked interesting, and here's a guy that was talking about 6 day creation, and I don't remember what it said, but it was a little short video, and I looked at it because it sounded like it was going to be pretty good. It may be something that he would have a point or two I could use someday when talking about creation with somebody. And it was, but he was slick, because he said, well, we've got to really work hard to understand the Bible correctly in Genesis 1. Okay. But then he starts saying, because we already have rejected the Bible in areas like that the earth did stand still, and he starts bringing up things to go, I haven't rejected that. I don't even know where the Bible says what you're saying. Well, he had twisted the Bible to say something it didn't say, so he could reject it to get you used to thinking about the fact, in his mind it was a fact, that the Bible varied off of that other places, so it probably wasn't going to be the right way to understand Genesis 1 either. And it's happening in lots of arenas with regard to the scriptures. We can go through all kinds of things. One that's obvious today is the world evaluates the Bible based on their feelings, at what makes them feel good and feel bad. And how could you make somebody feel bad by telling them they're a sinner and they might go to hell? I thought God was a loving God. Well, he is. But these things are out there, and we need to recognize that's what is happening. Even though I am fully convinced the people in this room would reject those things, we need to see what's happening in our world so we can be good testifiers in it. That is nothing more than the lies of Satan trying to take us away from the truth that we see in the scriptures. What's reliable in life? Scriptures. What's unreliable? Men and their own vision. And we get a good picture of that here in chapter 13 of Numbers. I'm not going to take the time to go here, but there are some good verses to go to. Proverbs 3, 5 through 7, if you want to look these up on your own, you may not have to look them up. You probably know what that one says. Trust in the Lord with all of your heart. Don't lean on your understanding. Follow him. 2 Timothy 3, 16 and 17 affirms the scriptures. In John 8, Jesus himself sets the stage and says, the truth will make you free. It's the truth that frees us, not some perception that mankind might try to lay on top of it. Questions, comments?
Do you know how much time elapsed between when Moses got the Ten Commandments to when the spies explored the land?
Well, I'm going to say several months. And that's based, the reason I would say that is we know there was about a month from their celebration of the Passover on their annual anniversary and their leaving. So there's one. And I'm guessing all the other things they went through till they got their tabernacle erected took at least a couple of months. So 3, 4.
So all those miracles were fresh in their mind, what God did.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We'll turn to their miracles that happened thousands of years ago. And we can hang on to them and go, yes, this is the kind of God we serve. They rejected that as a part of their thinking days, sometimes even one day after the miracle happened. So we ought not think we're wise and special. We ought to just thank God that we can see this is the God we serve. Somebody else, I thought. Dave.
Yeah, just a comment on verse 33 or chapter 13, the comment by the 10 spies that the giants in the land will address on was actually an absolute, almost an absolute fabrication,
mm-hmm.
and massive exaggeration.
Mm-hmm.
You get to Joshua and read about the land, they encountered very few giants. Very few.
Mm-hmm.
And the people of the land were scared to death of it, starting with the testimony of Rahab at Jericho and the Gibeonites, who disguised themselves as some wayfaring far away people to deceive them to make a covenant with Israel to protect themselves. Just an outright, almost satanic report
mm-hmm.
of those 10 spies. Incredible. And absolutely false.
Well, I think it is absolutely parallel with what Satan did with Eve. Just took him down a path that just is entirely of his making. I don't know how he accomplished it all other than these people seem to be quick to go in those directions, but
it's a real testimony. They're asking them to believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, Rahab believed more in the God of Israel than the Israelites did themselves.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, it is, and we'll get there when we get over to Joshua, but. I mean, these folks were much more scared of the Israelites than the other way around. And that's what God said he was going to do. And, well, what do you know? That's what God did. Good comment, Dave. Anything else?
I think in the next chapter, maybe not in the next chapter, that God knew the protection of those people, and he knew the protection of those people.
Mm-hmm.
And so those people actually get testimony in that when Israel arrived.
Yeah, well, it became known throughout the land what happened during their time of Exodus. That's part of what we studied previously when we were in the book of Exodus. So the people were hearing and scared. God was making himself known throughout the known world. All right, well, listen, I've abused your time just a little bit. We'll come back again next week and pick it up as they continue to work through what are we going to do now.